I'll tell you something funny about this collection. The first title was Too Jewish.
Oh my goodness, really?
Don't you think the stories are really too Jewish?
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rosa Loewinger, author of the new memoir, Dwell Time. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Sameach for the last time for a while. Today marks the last day of the long run of Jewish fall festivals, if you are conservative or Orthodox outside of the land of Israel, as today is Simchat Torah, the celebration of completing reading the entirety of the five books of the Torah publicly in the synagogue, and beginning again with Bereishit, Genesis. It's a fun way to finish the seemingly eternal run of holidays, happy and serious, that have filled this month of the Jewish calendar, Tishrei. Yesterday in Temple, on the festival of Shmini Atzeret, eighth day of assembly for Sukkot and an independent holiday in its own right, we chanted the beautiful blessing for rain, Geshem, and lovingly remembered our ancestors with Yisker prayers. We also chanted and read from the great book Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, from the final part of the Hebrew Bible, traditionally chanted on the Shabbat of Sukkot, which this year coincided with the eighth day of the holiday. If you don't recall the classic Bird's version of Pete Seeger's setting of this biblical text from Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, recorded way back in 1965, well, then you are missing or forgetting something great. It seems to me that song has been used to typify the mid-1960s in about, 50 movies, including Forrest Gump, and I've heard that it is the pop song that uses the absolute earliest text ever implemented, having taken this passage from Kohelet, a 2,300-year-old book, for its lyrics. Although, according to Jewish tradition, King Solomon actually wrote the book of Ecclesiastes 2,900 years ago. Now, if it was Solomon who wrote it, I wonder where they sent the royalty checks. Of course, Solomon was royalty. Never mind. Anyway, today we conclude this long fall festival season and put the extreme holiday experience of Judaism behind us for a little bit. Last night and today we enjoy Simchat Torah, the celebration of Torah, wonderful festival when we completed reading the Torah and began again with Bereishit. Before we leave the festival season in our rearview mirror, I have to share one favorite personal anecdote about Simchat Torah. The genesis of this particular personal story goes back to when I was living in Jerusalem. Having grown up knowing Simchat Torah as a wide open fun festival, on the night of Simchat Torah, also called Simchas Torah by some, we went looking for a party, dancing with the Torah's loud singing, maybe a schnapps or two or three to celebrate. What we discovered is that isn't the way Jerusalemites celebrate Simchat Torah. After wandering around the Jewish quarter of the old city of Jerusalem in search of revelry, we found a couple of Torah readings and plenty of stately hakafot, the Torah processionals, but no real parties. We decided to try the ultra-Orthodox area of Mea Shearim. Again, no great parties, no Jews dancing in the streets, none of the festivities we associate with Simchat Torah here in America. Finally, having found a bottle or two of Arak along the way and drinking a lot of it, we decided to create our own Simchas Torah celebration. A group of us began singing and dancing in the middle of a quiet intersection at the entrance to Mea Shearim. We worked up enough enthusiasm to attract a group of younger Orthodox Jews who were willing to come dance with these Meshuggah American revelers, singing Ki Heim Chayenu Hoshia Et Amecha and other Torah songs. Finally, we were having a good time when we heard a plop on the pavement near our dancing feet, then another, and then another. We realized that the neighbors living nearby were pelting us with fruit and using their leftover etrogim, the citrons from the holiday of Sukkot, that they didn't need anymore because, you know, it was over. Only in Jerusalem could that have happened. Well, to play us in this morning, here's a final Sukkot song written by Naomi Shemer. It's a classic Israeli kids' rendition about building a true Sukkot Shalom, a tabernacle of peace. This particular song, Shlomit Bona Sukkah, was performed by singer-entertainer Bruno Mars at a recent Israeli concert. He has one Jewish grandparent, by the way.
Shlomit Bona Sukkah, Mu'eret Viruka. על כן היא עסוקה היום ואין זו סתם סוכה מוארת וירוקה שלומית בונה סוכת שלום ואין זו סתם סוכה מוארת וירוקה שלומית בונה סוכת שלום
That was the Israeli kids classic Shlomit Bona Sukkah for the conclusion of our fall festivals today. Our guest on Too Jewish this morning is Rosa Loewinger, the Cuban-American Jewish author of the acclaimed new memoir, Dwell Time. She's a remarkable and fascinating guest, an architectural preservationist expert, an active Jew from a most unusual Cuban Jewish background. Her book is just terrific. She joins us in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
This Is Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. Who is Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? What do Jews believe about life after death? In three fun, inexpensive, informative sessions, This Is Judaism brings you the joy of Jewish life and learning. You'll study with Rabbi Sam Kohan and learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about. Plus, you can get a sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are at the Tucson JCC, the J, and are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, This Is Judaism is completely free, but the learning is invaluable. Want to know what your new Jewish relatives are all about? Want your kids to understand Jewish heritage, history, and holidays? Want to try some delicious Jewish food? Then This Is Judaism is for you. There's no charge, but you must pre-register by calling 520-276-5675. Visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. This Is Judaism is taught on three consecutive Sunday afternoons in September and October at the Tucson JCC. There's a free Zoom option, but registration is required. All classes are with Rabbi Sam Kohan. Remember, there's no obligation and registration is completely free for this wonderful introduction to Jewish life. Register for This Is Judaism by calling 520-276-5675. It's the most effective introduction to Jewish learning and life ever. For your very own entry or return to Judaism, visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. 276-5675.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish Art guests this morning. Rosa Loewinger is a Cuban-born writer and art conservator. That doesn't quite capture it. Her new memoir is called Dwell Time, a memoir of art, exile, and repair. It's extraordinary. She's the author of Tropicana Nights, Life and Times of the Legendary Cuban Nightclub, Promising Paradise, Cuban Allure, American Seduction, the founder and vice president of RLA Conservation, one of the largest women-owned art and architectural conservation firms, which plays an interesting and fascinating part in the book as well. She writes for a variety of publications in a variety of areas. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you for having me.
So you are definitely the first Cuban-American Jewish art preservationist I have ever interviewed on Two Jewish in 21 years. So
I'm not surprised.
Tell me your story. You dig deep into the origins of your family and family trauma and how it's kind of played out in your work. What motivated you to start this book? It's very open.
Yes. Well, this book came to me as an idea when I was living in Rome in 2009. I was a fellow at the American Academy in Rome doing a research project, and I stumbled upon a book I had never seen before, which was Primo Levi's The Periodic Table.
That's a fantastic book.
Amazing. I mean, it was a game changer for me. And when I read it, besides that it's a magnificent book for so many reasons, I felt as an art conservator whose work is, the work of art conservators is rarely featured in a logical way in literature because none of us have ever written a book for the general public before. I thought to myself...
Wait a minute. You mean those Gabriella Lone stories where he's a Mossad agent and he restores, you know, like Da Vinci's... That's not realistic?
Right. There you go. I need say no more, right? and they're good, by the way.
They're fun. They're a lot of fun.
Not really authentic to what we actually do.
I wouldn't think so.
No, and so when I saw that, I thought there's a way to structure a story about the work that art conservators and architectural conservators do around this same structure that Levi used in that book, which was to use the elements as the unifying principle. But that was 2009, and I didn't really know what the story was going to be. I knew it would be about conservation. I thought it could be about my family, but I didn't know quite how to frame it. And then it kind of came to me in 2020 in a conversation with someone. Well, actually, I'll tell you a little bit more detail. I was writing a novel about Cuba in the 50s, and a Romanian art conservator from Transylvania dropped into the narrative and started taking over, and I went, whoa.
How did this happen to me? It's an extraordinary book, and it journeys through some very important and interesting and I think not terribly well-explored areas of history and Jewish history as well. We will talk much more with Rosa Loewinger. Her book is called Dwell Time, a memoir of art, exile, and repair. We'll come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the Tucson metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services Friday night at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning at 9 a.m. for Torah study and 10 a.m. for services, or come to our services on our Facebook page. All of that's available on our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests. Call 520-276-5675. It's time to get those kids into Hebrew school. Religious schools open now for school-aged children or grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Friday night, 6:30 p.m. Shabbat services, followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat. Everybody's welcome. Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, and a kiddush afterwards. Always good food at Beit Simcha. You can email me directly, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. All of our services are led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those through the website. Religious school is available in blended format too. Some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kfetch or kfel, please email us at 2jewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, jewishradio18@gmail.com. Or go to our website, 2jewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America according to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify too. Post a rating, review 2 Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments help. TOOJewishRadio.com. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. As a general principle, Jewish holidays are divided between days on which you starve and days on which you must overeat. Although most Reform and Conservative Jews are more familiar with the overeating holidays and fast only on Yom Kippur, Orthodox Jews observe no fewer than, perhaps 16 fasts throughout the Jewish year, based on the time-honored principle that even if you are sure that you are already ritually purified, you aren't. In any case, although there are many Jewish feasts and fasts, there are no holidays requiring light snacking. Now, unlike Christians who attend church on special days like Ash Wednesday or Christmas, on Jewish holidays, most Jews take the day off. This is because for Jews, for historical and personal reasons, we are more stressed out. Anyway, this is your handy diet guide to Jewish holidays, starting with Rosh Hashanah. We began this year in September and going forward through the fall, winter, spring, and summer, all categorized by their dietary requirements. So here we go. Rosh Hashanah, feast. Tzom Gedalia, fast. Yom Kippur, more fasting. Sukkot, feast. Hoshana Rabbah, more feasting. Simchat Torah, today, keep feasting. The month of Cheshvan, no feasts or fast for an entire month. Get a grip. Hanukkah, eat latkes, potato pancakes. Tenth of Tevet, fast. Do not eat potato pancakes. Tu Bishvat, feast. Fast of Esther, yep, fast. Purim, eat pastry. Passover, do not eat pastry. Shavuot, feast, but only on dairy foods like cheesecake or blintzes. 17th of Tammuz, fast. Definitely don't eat cheesecake or blintzes. Tisha B'Av, very strict fast. Don't even think about cheesecake or blintzes. Month of Elul, end of cycle. Enroll in the Oprah Winfrey Center for Eating Disorders before the High Holy Days arrive and it starts all over again. I hope that's all clear. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking about Jews of the Ukraine. There was a contemporary event that connected having to do with the Holocaust in Canada. But I think the larger question that we probably ought to address is, like, what's the Ukrainian Jewish community like now? How big is it? How important is it? How much has it been affected by the war, and then maybe a little bit of the incredible history of Jews in Ukraine?
Well, all very complicated questions. No one knows, is the answer, how big the Jewish community is now. And a lot of the answer to that question depends on how do you define a Jew? Which movement's criteria do you use? Does a Jew have to have a Jewish mother, or is a Jewish father enough? Or is a Jewish grandparent enough? Or is self-identification enough? I mean, there are all kinds of different criteria, which result in very different numbers.
I mean, it's really fascinating when you think about it. There's a Jewish president, right? Zelensky, who's become the face of the country and the world. There's a number of other Jews in his cabinet, but very little Jewish background for any of them, I would say, probably.
Well, that's because in the Soviet period, Jewish education was completely illegal and basically eliminated. So,
of course.
Both Jewish learning and Jewish practice were severely stifled during the entire Soviet period. And now there's a renaissance being helped by sort of emissaries from different Hasidic sects, particularly Chabad, but also from the Reform movement.
Absolutely. A friend of mine, David Wilfond, was the first, opened the first synagogue in Kyiv, you know, years ago.
He's a common
long time
friend.
Ago now. I should have said our mutual friend, Gingy, right. Who's been on the radio show a couple of times himself, several times himself.
Right. So the standing joke about Odessa and its very rich Jewish community is some visitor asked a local, how many Jews live in Odessa? And the guy said, I just told you the population of Odessa is 1 million people.
Yeah.
That's the answer. Basically that everybody in Odessa has enough Jewish blood to be considered a Jew or to lay claim to that. And there are like functioning synagogues and a kosher restaurant, and Odessa, at least until the war, was a thriving, beautiful city, but one of many significant Jewish communities throughout Ukraine. I think I told you before we started broadcasting that Donetsk has the largest Jewish community in the world. But then I realized it's probably Dnipro, which is the Ukrainian name for what the Russians called Dnipropetrovsk, which is a mouthful. But I mean, I got the D right anyway. And there's like a 40-story Jewish community center there that has a hotel and a mikveh and several kosher restaurants.
40-story Jewish community center in Ukraine.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, not incredible. The first place you think of in terms of Jewish population in Ukraine. It's neither Donetsk nor Dnipro. The big centers of Jewish life have always been Kyiv, Odessa, and Lviv.
Right. Which used to be known as Kiev and Lvov, for those of you who have old memories of the area.
Right. Right. But one of the things Ukrainians have done is they've accelerated a very intensive nationwide process of converting people from speaking Russian, which they learned in school, to Ukrainian.
Right.
And even like a good friend of mine who used to be a personal trainer in gyms in Kyiv is now in the army. And he's speaking and writing in Ukrainian now, although, of course, he still knows Russian from his entire education, first 20 years of his life or so. It's a very interesting transition, and we'll talk more about the Jewish community next week.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Towards the end of the Shabbos morning service, just after Simchat Torah, Rabbi Goldstein asked his congregation, "On Yom Kippur a couple weeks ago, I asked you all to forgive your enemies. So, how many of you have forgiven your enemies?" Maybe 80% of the congregation raises their hands. Rabbi Goldstein asks again, "Come on now, we can do better than that. How many of you have really forgiven your enemies?" Everyone eventually raises a hand this time. Everybody except one very elderly man, Mr. Steinberg. "Mr. Steinberg, glad you're here today. Good Shabbos," says the rabbi. "Aren't you willing to forgive your enemies?" "I don't have any," he replies. "Mr. Steinberg, that's very unusual," says the rabbi. "How old are you?" "I'm 98 years old," he replies proudly. The congregation oohs, ahs. "Okay, Mr. Steinberg," says the rabbi, "would you please tell us, how can a person live 98 years and not have a single enemy in the world?" Old Mr. Steinberg rises slowly, turns to the congregation and says simply, "I outlived all the momsers." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This coming Shabbat, we read the spectacular Torah portion of Bereishit, Genesis, beginning of everything. It starts with those still amazing words, Bereishit bara Elohim, at the beginning of God's creating, or in the beginning God created. Simple, lucid, clear, all creation emanating from one point and place, a divine force or intelligence or energy starting the great process of existence and eventually of all life, a singularity, a poem to the holy unity of being. We all come from the same source. And yet, the text of Genesis is deliberately ambiguous to encourage exploration and debate, those essential tools we human beings have for learning truth and discerning meaning. Questions abound. Why God at all? As the great Jewish poet Paul Celan wrote, "No one needs us again out of earth and clay. No one summons our dust. Blessed art thou, no one." Well, I'd argue with Celan, that most Jewish of activities argument, right? That such a wonder as creation did not come into being purely by accident, for beauty, it seems, rarely happens by chance in this universe we know. But there is room for argument, which is good and God-given as well. The notion that God created and then saw each thing as good, provoked from the great British author D.H. Lawrence, the poetic speculation that the true mystery of creation is the divine urge of creation, a great strange urge. It's not a mind. Even an artist knows that his work was never in his mind. He could never have thought it before it happened. God is a great urge, wonderful, mysterious, magnificent, but knows nothing beforehand. His urge takes shape in the flesh, and lo, it is creation. God looks on it himself in wonder for the first time. Ah, there is a creature formed. How strange. Let me think about it now. Let me form an idea. Again, we can argue, discuss, explore. Such a marvel as the intricate workings of our world, of our bodies, even of a single cell, could not exist without some coherent plan or design. But still, what a rich area for discussion, exploration, engagement. Genesis is where real understanding begins. This is where we start to shape our faith, our theology. This helps mark our character. That's where the Torah starts, all right, with the invitation to begin exploring a great and sacred text in partnership with God, in community with the whole people of Israel throughout history. What a great way to begin again. When we come back in a moment, our guest this morning, Rosa Loewinger, shares stories of life and work in Cuba and how it impacted her extraordinary memoir, Dwell Time. Find out when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Drew Weissman, Jewish scientist who identified the technology that made possible the mRNA vaccines against COVID-19, won the 2023 Nobel Prize in Medicine last week. Weissman shared the prize with Catalin Carrico, his Hungarian-born research partner at the University of Pennsylvania. Carrico and Weissman's story of collaboration became famous in 2020 when the technology they started experimenting with more than 20 years earlier allowed the swift creation of effective vaccines against the crippling pandemic. The pair first encountered each other while photocopying research papers in 1998, and they realized they were working on related topics. Carrico, who had been a low-level researcher for years, was trying to prove that messenger RNA, the genetic material that tells cells what to do, could be programmed. Weissman, a physician who previously worked under Dr. Anthony Fauci, later U.S. COVID czar at the National Institutes of Health, was working on a vaccine against HIV. They teamed up. In 2005, they published a paper showing that mRNA could in fact be altered to instruct cells to take certain actions. But their breakthrough was widely overlooked for decades until it became clear that it could be used to take action against COVID-19, which was killing hundreds of thousands of people and crippling the global economy. Their technology fueled both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, which arrived with unusual speed and effectiveness in late 2020, and together have been administered millions of times. Through their groundbreaking findings, which have fundamentally changed our understanding of how mRNA interacts with our immune system, the laureates contributed to the unprecedented rate of vaccine development during one of the greatest threats to human health in modern times, the Nobel Prize Committee said in announcing the award. Weissman is the son of a Jewish father and non-Jewish mother who grew up celebrating Jewish holidays. Together with his wife, Mary Ellen, who grew up in a more observant Jewish home, he sent his kids to Hebrew school at Temple Beth Hillel Bethel, a conservative synagogue in suburban Philadelphia. Mary Ellen Weissman herself is heavily involved in Momentum, which seeks to engage Jewish women with Israel, and together with her husband has spoken to and donated to the Zionist organization. 40% of Nobel Prize winners in medicine have at least one Jewish parent. 24% of all Nobel Prize winners overall are Jewish, while Jews form just 1/5 of 1% of all people on the planet. The oldest known complete edition of the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, arrived in Israel last week and will be put on display at the Anu Museum in Tel Aviv. The Codex Sassoon, as it's known, is to be displayed permanently at the Anu Museum immediately, describing it as a rare and valuable testimony to the history of the biblical text, according to the museum itself. The book was bought at auction in New York for $38 million in May, as reported on Too Jewish, and donated to the Tel Aviv Museum. The price makes the Bible, which weighs about 7 pounds, the most expensive Jewish manuscript in history. It contains handwritten signs indicating how it is to be read aloud, trope, cantillations, and notes on chanting as well. The traditions for reading the Torah aloud were handed down orally up until about the 7th century. Then instructions were provided via diacritical and cantillation marks. Notes were added in the margins and between the columns. Those notes are called Masoretic notes, and the Codex Sassoon has an abundance of them, some of them perhaps not as well known as the standard ones. Three books in the world are recognized as nearly complete Masoretic texts. The Aleppo Codex, on display at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. It's actually missing a few pages that were lost when the Arabs rioted in Aleppo in the early 20th century. And the Leningrad Codex, on display at a museum in St. Petersburg. And, of course, this Codex Sassoon, to be in Tel Aviv. The Codex Sassoon is created more than 1,100 years ago, somewhere around where Israel and Syria interact today. The funds to purchase it for the museum were donated by a Swiss Jewish family. And finally, the long-standing decline in the conservative Jewish movement continued apace, with the news that the Schechter Day School on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, one of just two surviving conservative movement-branded day schools left in the five New York boroughs, will close. It is kind of merging with the Reform Congregation Rod of Shalom's day school, with its two major educators joining the staff there. The conservative movement, once the largest of American Jewish movements, has been in steady decline for the last, 40 years or so. There is no real positive end in sight. Last year, the major West Coast campus of the movement, American Jewish University in Los Angeles, was sold off. You know, if you want to be Jewish in America today, conservative Judaism is just not where it's happening. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews around the world. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Rosa Loewinger is the author of the new book, Dwell Time, a memoir of art, exile, and repair. A Cuban-born American writer and art conservator who has done extensive art conservatory work with her own company all around the world, and has a great story to tell here, author of two other books as well. Your parents play such an important part in this memoir. It's both a powerful and a painful story at a variety of times. How was it to write about that?
Well, you know, it's always delicate territory to write about one's parents, especially when they're alive, because the intention of doing that is to speak your own truth while being mindful of not doing harm to people. And, you know, it's tricky because my mother suffered a great deal of trauma as a young girl, and that colored her entire life, and it colored my young life. And there was no way around that fact. But that was the through line in the narrative. And the amazing thing about it is that the writing of it and talking to her while I wrote it and her understanding what I was doing and ultimately reading it was in itself an act of repair. So, you know.
Well, I think you work that in so magnificently because you talk about your mother's focus on beauty because her beauty got her out of the slums, right?
Exactly.
And how that probably impacted your focus on conserving beauty and preserving and restoring beauty.
Absolutely. And also my mother is obsessed with cleaning because she lived in such a dirty environment, a tenement house.
Filth. Yeah.
And with shared bathrooms and rats. And so she's obsessed with cleaning, as many Jewish mothers are. But with her, it's taken to a whole art form. And I, as a conservator, you know, we do many different kinds of things. But one of the things we do is clean. And that's always my favorite part of the job. So I see so many links to her.
So to be an art conservator, do you have to be a little bit OCD?
Yeah, I think so. There's a definite OCD quality to it. And that's the beauty of the balance, though, because we have to be a little OCD, but we also have to be able to pull back and see big picture. Because you can be OCD all you want, but when you're dealing at the scale of a building, there's only so much that you can control on a micro scale. You have to be looking at the macro picture. And that's why I like to work on a large scale, which is the work I do.
Tell us about your relationship with your father a little bit.
I am very much like my father, and everybody tells me this. My father was an artist at birth. He was a man that wanted to make art. He wanted to be an architect and wasn't able to follow his dream. And he was a very hardworking guy and who tried to do his best to be successful, but it's like they put the round peg in the square hole, and he managed all right. But I felt a lot of his heartbreak toward the end of his life about what he couldn't achieve. And yet he was surrounded by love and family, which is another thing that was so important to him.
In creating this book, you know, your family comes from tragedy in Europe, comes to Cuba, and then the communist takeover. Tell us how you balance the political and the personal in creating this.
Certainly. Well, it's always, for Cubans, I guess just for Jews as well, right?
Right.
We're always balancing the political and the personal because you always have to be measured in how you look at things because it's very easy to just simply demonize the Cuban government, the Cuban communist government, who has done many bad things. But you have to look back at what came before it and what led to it, which is something that we like to think that nothing leads to anything, but everything does. And that was the balance that I've had. And I've always had the balance in my work ever since I started going back to Cuba, which is, comes up in the book, when I finally go back and start seeing that my profession, which is conservation, was a means of starting to understand a little bit about what was left behind and what needed to be repaired. People have often said to me, well, why do you go back to Cuba? Aren't you just helping the Castro government or the communist government as it is now? And my response has always been that heritage and historic buildings and a country's cultural wealth does not belong to a government. It belongs to the people. And in the case of Cuba, which is so uniquely positioned and has such an amazing amount of historic buildings, it's a world legacy. And to ignore it and to abdicate it to a government just because you don't like that government is ridiculous. But I'm always threading that needle, you know?
The process of, I think, conservation, which is so central as a theme, really, in your life, it's not always about conservation. Like, you talk about sort of the reckless quality of your life for a while. Was that difficult to write about? And tell us a little bit more about that experience in that period of your life.
I think when you're talking about the reckless part of my life, you may be referring to the parts where I write about how I entered into my first marriage with not really a clear sense of how I was going to manage to be in a relationship with someone and how I bounced around wondering why I was there. And even though I remained married for a long time and and have nothing but good things to say about my ex-husband. It was a fraught relationship. That was, of course, difficult to write about, and I sort of fought it tooth and nail for a while. I was thinking, how can I get away without writing this? But then I thought that was so dishonest. There was no way not to, because you can't write about other people's foibles without turning the mirror to yourself first and foremost. Because, you know, so to give an example, my mother was problematic when I was a very little girl because she was so terrified about what was going on around her and how suddenly the bottom had been pulled out from under her. Okay, I can't write about her struggles with me as her child without writing about what I did. But you want to also be careful about how you treat the people who are around you and that you care about.
So how has your family reacted?
Okay, I gave my ex-husband the manuscript to read before I published it, and I said, is there anything in here that you object to? And he said no. I gave it to my son, who's a grown man. He also said no. Then, of course, the tough one was my mother, right?
Yeah.
Because...
Well, she's such an important character in this book, I mean, in your life.
Right. Right. Well, first of all, she's a fabulous character.
Not oh my just, goodness! Yeah.
Right. Not is she. Not only is.
Yeah.
She,
I mean, if you'd invented her in a novel, it'd be great, right?
Right. Right. Right.
But then, of course, you wouldn't have to live with her. So it's a.
Exactly. Exactly. But she's 91, and she's full of full of opinions and attitudes and whatever. She's a giant presence in our family. You know, she was, the act of generosity of reading that book, seeing yourself portrayed at times, because not always, in a dark way. And then she suffered a little bit. She did. She had some sleepless nights around it. And I gave it to her, the manuscript also, when there was still time to change things. And I said, is there anything you want me to remove? And the only thing she asked me to remove from the book was one mention of a foible of my father's. The only one she wanted to protect was him because he was gone.
Huh.
And so, you know, the idea, like, nobody wants to be portrayed nobody wants to be the subject of a book, right?
Right.
If they can't control the narrative. And in her case, she's not always portrayed in the brightest light. And yet her accepting of it and saying, No, go ahead and do it. I don't remember a lot of these things, which is understandable because a lot of us don't remember how we behave at our most fraught and frightened moments. But go ahead, I trust you. I trust that you are telling your truth. I mean, that's a pretty compelling act of generosity, in my opinion.
There's one project I have to ask you about because I'm from Los Angeles, born there, and you saved the Watts Towers, right?
Well, I wouldn't quite put myself so central to the project. It was an engineer named Bud Goldstone that actually showed that the towers could withstand seismic forces. But I was the first professional conservator to consult on the towers. They had other conservators, but I was the first one with like modern training to consult on the towers and help develop the plan for their repair. And since then, there have been a couple of other teams that have worked on it and developed from there additional plans. And now they are being stewarded and cared for on an ongoing basis by the Los Angeles County Museum of Art,
right,
and a team that takes care of them on a regular basis. When I started working on them, there was this kind of notion that we could repair them and that would be it. But now it's pretty much understood that it's an ongoing project.
You know, without revealing too many other aspects of it. Tell us a little bit about how you feel about Cuba now.
Well, I love Cuba very much. I love the country. I love the people. I feel very fortunate that this accident of immigration, U.S. immigration policy, sent my grandfathers there instead of to the United States.
Yeah. Thank God.
We were only there as a family for about 35 years. But it has entirely colored us. It's like we've been dipped in a varnish that is Cuban. If you met my mother, you would think of her as, you know, she's like a lenticular. They're like, you look at her one way and she's a Jewish lady, and you look at her another way and she's a Cuban lady. So I feel a tremendous amount of affinity for everything that that culture has imbued my family with. And I love the country, and I love the people, and I hate the government. And that's not necessarily untrue of how I feel about certain other governments, which we don't have to discuss. But, you know, it's a place of extraordinary exuberance. It's a crossroads, ethnically, racially, religiously, and I could go on about Cuba forever. I love it there. I love taking people there. I've taken Jewish groups, fine art groups, and actually, given that this is a Jewish podcast, one funny thing is when, at a certain point, when we were taking a lot of contemporary art groups to Cuba, and I think it was George W. Bush closed the door on travel to Cuba, but on anything but religious groups, and essentially all the contemporary art groups just kind of reformed as Jewish groups.
That's Jewish, because they were Jewish anyway. So.
They were Jewish anyway, and they just basically... switched the way they were, but they were doing the same thing. It's pretty funny.
Tell us a little bit about your Jewish identity and how it impacts the work that you do.
Well, when we came to this country, of course, my family has always identified as Jewish. In Cuba, we were part of the Cuban Jewish community, my grandfather being one of the founders of the conservative synagogue that goes by the name El Patronato in Vedado. Uh-huh. His name's on a plaque in the lobby. And when we came here to Miami in 61, we did not go to live in Little Havana. The Jews settled in Miami Beach. And there was a particular synagogue in Miami Beach called Temple Menorah, whose rabbi opened his arms to the Cuban Jewish community and let the members join the synagogue for free because nobody had any money. And what happened for me is that over time, I became best friends with this rabbi's daughter, Rina. And my life was colored by this sort of Jewish experience. I also went to an Orthodox Jewish day school at a certain point because in Cuba you sent your kids to Jewish schools, and I had a bad encounter with a public school teacher who was very xenophobic, and my parents sent me to the Hebrew Academy of Greater Miami, which was an Orthodox day school. But remember, back in the 60s, Orthodox was not what it is now.
No, it was, right? A different, you know, experience. Yeah.
Different animal.
Absolutely.
And what, to me, being Jewish was always sort of a cornerstone of my identity. I went to Brandeis. I always joined, you know, I was never like strictly observant, but I always was a member of a community. It's very important to me to be part of a community. And in Philadelphia, the place that I adored living, part of the Jewish community there, which was centered around something called the Center City Chavura Minyan, was kind of the center of my social life. And in L.A., when we moved to L.A., it was Temple Beth Am for a while.
Yeah.
And then I'm a member of a very extraordinary and vibrant community in L.A. now called Ikar.
Yeah, I know Ikar well, and I've had Sharon Brouse on the show a couple times.
And I'm actually doing a program with her in December on Shabbat. But
how fun.
It's a very meaningful part of my identity.
I'm sorry, we're just out of time. I want to thank Rosa Lowinger for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Dwell Time, A Memoir of Art, Exile, and Repair, and it's terrific, and everybody should read it. Thank you so much for being here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you?
Thank you.
Where can people go to find out more about you, Rosa?
Oh, they can go to my website, to rosalowinger.com, and you can reach out to me if you want to email me about anything. And I'll be presenting at a lot of places, and it's all on my website. I'm doing a lot of appearances at various places around the country.
Thank you so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan, this morning. Join us next week. Our guest will be Rabbi Andy Green, who recently completed the conversion of an entire community of Messianic Christians to Judaism, led by their pastor here in Sholo, Arizona. Quite a story. Don't miss it. Join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too. 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading in Kiddush, live in person on our Facebook page. And This Is Judaism class for free, but you got to pre-register, starts today at 2 p.m. You can register on our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our playout this morning comes for Simchat Torah, last of the holidays until Hanukkah, a Simchat Torah medley of, you guessed it, joyous song. My friends, a final Chag Sameach and Moadim LeSimcha, Chagim Uzmanim LeSason. A happy end of the Jewish fall holidays with Simchat Torah, and may you enjoy seasons of celebration and joy, and of course, going forward, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.